Welcome to Base by Base. Get ready to explore the incredible microscopic world inside our cells, a universe far more complex and dynamic than, you know, just simple bags filled with fluid. Today, we're looking at these fascinating structures within the cell's liquid environment that aren't surrounded by membranes. They form through processes kind of like oil and vinegar separating, creating these tiny droplets or phases called biomolecular condensates.
That's right. And a really fundamental question in cell biology is getting a handle on the physical properties of these condensates. Are they runny like liquid, stiff like a gel, maybe solid?
Yep.
Or something in between. These material properties can be absolutely crucial for their function, but actually figuring out their, let's say, squishiness inside a living cell, you know, in their native environment, well, that's been incredibly challenging with the traditional methods.
And our focus today is on one specific, very busy hub within the nucleus, the nucleolus. You can think of it as the cell's main factory for building ribosomes.
Mm-hmm, the protein makers.
Exactly, the complex molecular machines churning out all the proteins the cell needs. This factory is just packed dense with proteins and RNA, and for a while now, scientists have had this hunch, right, that its physical state, its stiffness or fluidity might not just be a side effect. It might actively help organize the incredibly intricate multi-step process of ribosome assembly.
Yeah, precisely. And we're going to unpack a really fascinating piece of research that looks directly at this. It's a paper published in PNAS back in 2025 by Dr. Holly Cheng and her colleagues. They used a really powerful technique to directly probe the material properties of the nucleolus within a living cell nucleus. It gives us a unique window.
Okay, so our exploration today, using their source material, is really to understand what this paper reveals about the nucleolus's physical nature. You know, how do different parts of this factory behave physically? What influences those properties? And ultimately, why is understanding its physical state just so important for how cells actually work? Let's get into it.
Okay, so first off, maybe just a quick recap on why these bimolecular condensates and their physical properties matter so much. As you said, they form often through this process called liquid phase separation. Specific molecules, like certain proteins and RNA, spontaneously gather together, concentrating themselves into these droplets, separate from the surrounding cellular fluid, the cytoplasm or nucleoplasm.
Right.
And their nature, whether they're liquid-like or maybe more solid-like, they can dramatically influence how quickly molecules move around inside them and interact. It basically sets the stage for biochemical reactions, controlling rates and pathways.
And it's more than just efficiency, right? You mentioned disease links.
Absolutely. What's really significant is that changes in these physical properties, like, say, a condensate incorrectly hardening or gelling up when it shouldn't, are increasingly being linked to serious diseases, like neurodegeneration.
Okay, so clearly important to study. But you both mentioned studying their squishiness in vivo inside the living cell is the hard part. What were the older ways, and why weren't they quite enough?
Well, existing techniques often had to rely on indirect measurements, or they had to make certain assumptions about the material. For example, a common method is FRAP.
Fluorescence recovery after photobleaching.
Exactly. You bleach a spot of fluorescent molecules inside a condensate, then watch how quickly unbleached ones move back in. It gives clues about diffusion speed, which relates to viscosity.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really a measure of molecular mobility, not the bulk physical properties of the entire condensate structure. And it doesn't tell you much about elasticity or solid-like characteristics.
Yeah.
Plus, the fluorescent tag itself can sometimes mess with how the molecule behaves.
And things like fusion assays, watching them merge.
Yeah, fusion assays give some insight, but they often just assume simple liquid behavior, you know, driven solely by surface tension. None of these really give you a direct measure of how the bulk material resists a physical force.
Okay, so that brings us to the methods in this paper by Dr. Cheng and colleagues. How did they get that direct measurement? They used micropipette aspiration, or MPA. I'm still picturing that tiny straw. How does sucking on a tiny droplet measure stiffness?
Hey, yeah, the tiny straw analogy is pretty good, actually. MPA involves using a very fine glass pipette tip, applying a really precisely controlled suction pressure onto the surface of the material you're interested in.
Okay.
As you apply that pressure, the material gets drawn into the pipette. And by carefully measuring how much material deforms and gets pulled in, and crucially how quickly it deforms over time under that constant pressure, you can calculate its physical properties, things like viscosity and elasticity.
So it's a direct measure of resistance to that pulling force.
Exactly. It's a well-established method for looking at whole cells or maybe isolated organelles, but the real challenge, the innovation here, was adapting it for these much smaller intracellular condensates, like the nucleolus, inside the nucleus. Usually they're just too small for this.
Ah, and that's where the frog comes in. The Xenopus laevis oocyte. Why was that the key system here?
Precisely. Xenopus laevis are African clawed frogs. And their oocytes, their egg cells, are just enormous single cells, like 1 to 1.3 millimeters across. Huge.
Wow.
And critically for this research, their nuclei, which are called germinal vesicles, or GVs, are also very large. And inside these GVs, there isn't just one nucleolus. There are hundreds, maybe even thousands, of very large nucleoli, up to about 10 micrometers in diameter.
Okay, so large enough to actually target with the micropipette?
Exactly. These giant nucleoli are big enough to be directly approached and aspirated by a micropipette tip, which might have a diameter of just 1 or 2 micrometers. It makes them this unique, almost ideal system to apply MPA in vivo inside a relatively intact nucleus.
And they checked these nucleoli were still functioning?
Yes, that was important. The researchers carefully confirmed that these large nucleoli were still transcriptionally active, so making RNA, even after they isolated the GV for the experiment. So they were studying a functionally relevant state.
Okay, so the methods are clear. MPA on these uniquely large active nucleoli. Let's move to the results. What did they actually see when they started aspirating? You mentioned the nucleolus isn't uniform.
No, that's absolutely key. The nucleolus in these frog oocytes, just like in our own cells, is organized into distinct subcompartments.
Yeah.
Think of them as different zones on the ribosome assembly line.
Right.
You've got the innermost fibrillar center, the FDC, surrounded by the dense fibrillar component, the DFC, and then the outermost layer is the granular component, the GC ribosome assembly, starts deep inside, and the parts move outwards through these layers.
And how did they visualize these different layers during the aspiration? How could they tell what part they were sucking into the pipette?
They used fluorescence microscopy. They cleverly introduced fluorescently tagged proteins that are known markers for specific compartments.
Mm-hmm.
They used nucleophosmin, or NPM1. Tagged with RFP, a red fluorescent protein, which lights up the GC. And they used fibrillarin, or FIB1, tagged with EGFP, a green fluorescent protein, which marks the DFC and FC.
Uh-huh.
So by looking at the red and green fluorescence alongside standard DIC microscopy, which shows the structure, they could clearly see the boundaries and watch in real time as different parts of the nucleolus entered the pipette tip.
Brilliant. So what were the results? What did the aspiration reveal about the physical behavior of these different layers? Were they the same or different?
Oh, dramatically different. The results showed a really surprising level of internal physical organization.
Mm-hmm.
When they applied a constant suction pressure,
mm-hmm.
the outer GC layer, the red layer, behaved pretty much like a standard simple fluid. The length of the material pulled into the pipette just increased steadily, almost linearly, over the time they watched, which was generally, you know, longer than about 10 seconds.
And when they stopped pulling?
When they released the pressure and injected the GC material, it snapped back quickly into a spherical shape. Just what you'd expect a liquid droplet to do, driven by surface tension, trying to minimize the surface area.
Okay, so the outer GC is liquid-like. What about the inner DFC-FC, the green part?
Fundamentally different behavior. When that material entered the pipette, the aspiration was much, much slower. It visibly resisted the deformation more strongly than the GC.
Right.
And crucially, the deformation wasn't linear over time. Instead of steadily increasing, the length pulled into the pipette tended to slow down and level off, reaching a nearly constant position, even though the pressure was still being applied.
Ah, so it wasn't flowing continuously.
Exactly. That kind of behavior where deformation saturates under constant stress is really characteristic of something solid-like, or maybe like a viscoelastic solid or a gel, something that resists flow and can hold its shape, at least partially.
And the ejection test, what happened when they pushed the DFC back out?
That was maybe the most visually striking difference. Unlike the GC, which rounded up immediately, the aspirated DFC material retained the cylindrical shape it had inside the pipette for much, much longer. They showed examples where it stayed deformed for hundreds of seconds.
Wow. So yeah, direct visualization. The nucleolus isn't just one thing physically. It's got this more solid-like, gel-like core, the DFC-FC, wrapped in a more liquid-like shell, the GC. That's a major finding about its internal structure.
Absolutely. It demonstrates that the biochemical compartments we knew about also have distinct physical properties.
Mm-hmm.
There's a physical compartmentalization alongside the biochemical one.
Okay, so let's get into the discussion around this. Why? What makes the inner part solid-like and the outer part liquid-like? The paper points pretty strongly towards RNA, doesn't it?
It really does. The leading hypothesis, which their data strongly supports, is that it's the RNA itself. Specifically, the high concentration of newly transcribed ribosomal RNA, the rRNA, right there in the DFC region.
The stuff that's being made right there.
Exactly. These are long, complex RNA molecules being actively synthesized. The idea is that these long RNAs might get tangled up, entangle with each other, and interact with proteins to form a dense, interconnected network, almost like a molecular mesh or gel. And that network is what gives the DSC its partially solid, viscoelastic character. Then, as these RNAs get processed, cut, modified, folded, and start getting packaged up with ribosomal proteins as they move outwards towards the GC, that dense RNA network naturally breaks down.
And that leads to the more fluid GC.
That's the idea. The breakdown of that structural RNA network would result in the more fluid, less structured, liquid-like properties they observed in the GC.
So how did they test this RNA dependency? This seems like a key part of their results and discussion. What experiment confirmed RNA was the key factor?
They did a pretty direct experiment. They injected RNase A, that's an enzyme that specifically chews up RNA directly into the nucleus, the GV, of the oocyte.
Okay, makes sense. If RNA is the scaffold, get rid of it and see what happens.
Precisely. If RNA is essential for the DFC's solid-like state, degrading it should dramatically change the DFC's physical behavior.
And did it? What were the results of that experiment? Was it a subtle change or?
Oh, it was absolutely dramatic. Really clear results. After the RNase A treatment, they observed significant changes. Visually, the DFCs within the nucleoli became much more spherical, less irregularly shaped than in the untreated nucleoli.
Interesting.
And even more striking, when they pushed two of these RNase-treated DFCs together, they fused very rapidly, like within seconds. This was in sharp contrast to untreated DFCs, which barely fused at all or did so incredibly slowly.
Wow, so fusion behavior changed completely. What about the aspiration?
That changed completely too. In the MPA experiments, the RNase-treated DFC behaved totally differently under suction. It lost that saturating solid-like deformation. Instead, it deformed continuously under pressure, much more like a fluid, just like the untreated GC behaved.
And the ejection.
Same story. When they ejected the aspirated material from the RNase-treated DFC, it relaxed rapidly back into a sphere, again behaving just like the GC.
Incredible. So the results are clear. Degrading the RNA fluidizes the DFC core, turns it from something solid-like into something behaving much more like a liquid.
Did they quantify this change, put numbers on it?
Yes, their quantitative analysis backed this up, although they are careful to note some caveats. The exact numbers can depend a bit on the specific physical model you use for the calculations. But the analysis confirmed that the viscoelastic, solid-like behavior of the DFC was essentially lost after RNase treatment. It started behaving more like a fluid.
Okay.
Now, here's a really interesting, maybe slightly counterintuitive detail from their results. While the behavior became more fluid-like, it lost its solid character, flowed more continuously, rounded up faster. Their quantitative estimates suggested its effective viscosity actually increased quite a bit after RNase treatment, up to maybe around 1,000 Pascal seconds.
Wait, hang on. More fluid-like behavior, but higher viscosity. How does that work? That sounds backwards. It does sound a bit paradoxical, doesn't it? It highlights that viscosity isn't the whole story, especially when interfaces are involved. The rapid rounding up and fusion they saw visually seems to be driven primarily by a large increase in the estimated interfacial tension.
The surface tension at the edge.
Exactly. The energy at the boundary between the DFC and its surroundings, like the GC or the nucleoplasm. They estimated this tension became about 10 times higher after they degraded the RNA. A much higher interfacial tension provides a much stronger driving force for the droplet to minimize its surface area. Hence, become spherical faster.
I see. So the viscosity measures internal resistance to flow once it is flowing, but the tension is the driving force making it want to change shape in the first place.
You've got it. So removing the RNA seems to do two main things based on their interpretation. One, it disrupts the internal RNA gel network, causing it to lose its solid-like resistance and allowing it to flow more readily if you apply force over time. But two, it also fundamentally changes the boundary, dramatically increasing the interfacial tension, which makes processes like rounding up and fusion happen much faster visually.
That's a much richer picture. RNA isn't just making it stiff, it's controlling both the internal structure and the surface properties.
Exactly. So the core conclusion here is that RNA acts as a key determinant of the nucleolus's material properties, both its internal viscoelasticity and the interfacial tension between its subcompartments. And the spatial gradient and physical state, the solid-like DFC core, the liquid-like GC shell, this isn't just some passive consequence. The interpretation is that it's likely essential for the actual process of ribosome biogenesis.
Okay, so let's discuss that functional significance. How does having a stiff, solid-like DFC core actually help make ribosomes? What's the proposed advantage?
Well, the hypothesis is that this entangled RNA network in the DFC acts as a sort of physical scaffold or perhaps a kinetic trap. It could physically slow down or hold the newly made RNAs and all of the necessary processing proteins right there in that specific region.
Keep them from wandering off too soon.
Precisely. This might be essential to ensure these molecules stick around long enough to undergo all the necessary precise processing steps, modifications, cleavages, initial protein binding in the correct sequence. If everything diffused away too quickly, the whole assembly line could fall apart or become inefficient.
So the solid-like state provides organization in time and space for the biochemistry.
That's the idea. It's a physical mechanism using material state to help organize a very complex biochemical pathway. It ensures steps happen in the right place and maybe at the right pace before the components move to the more dynamic, liquid-like GC for the later assembly stages.
It really is fascinating to think of the physics actively directing the biology. So, stepping back, what's the bigger picture significance discussed in the paper? What does this mean for cell biology overall?
I think this work provides some of the most direct in vivo evidence linking the specific material properties of a biomolecular condensate directly to a biological function within a living nucleus. It really emphasizes that the physical state itself is a functional parameter, not just the chemical composition.
Right.
For instance, they speculate that the viscosity of the GC might actually tune the speed at which finished subunits move out, potentially influencing the overall rate of ribosome production for the cell.
And could the cell control this?
That's a very exciting possibility raised by their discussion. Could the cell dynamically adjust these properties? The stiffness, the fluidity based on its metabolic state or its needs, perhaps by altering RNA levels, RNA modifications, or the proteins that interact with RNA. That opens up a whole new level of regulation.
And the disease connection again.
Yes. This reinforces the idea that disruptions in these material properties may be caused by mutations affecting RNA structure or by protein aggregation altering the condensate's physics could be a direct mechanism contributing to disease. We know the nucleolus looks different or functions poorly in many cancers, aging and these specific genetic diseases called ribosomopathies.
Yeah.
Perhaps changes in its physical state are a key part of why things go wrong.
So what are the next steps? Does the paper point towards future research directions or acknowledge limitations in their study?
They do. They acknowledge several limitations, which, as often happens in science, point towards exciting future work. For instance, their measurements were mostly sensitive to behavior on timescales longer than about 10 seconds. They couldn't rule out viscoelasticity in the GC on much shorter timescales. Probing that would need faster techniques. Also, their quantitative modeling, while informative, used simplified assumptions about the materials being uniform. More sophisticated models could potentially refine the estimates of viscosity and tension. And they treated the DFC as one thing, but biologically, there's likely variation within the DFC as RNA processing happens. Future studies with higher resolution might probe that internal heterogeneity.
Anything else?
Yes, one quite intriguing point they noted was that the very process of isolating the GV from the oocyte seemed to affect the GC's viscosity compared to estimates in fully intact cells.
Mm-hmm.
This hints that factors in the cytoplasm may be related to metabolic activity or ATP levels, the cell's energy currency, might normally help maintain or actively tune these properties in vivo. That suggests a fascinating link between cell state and condensate physics.
Really interesting possibilities there. So to summarize the conclusions of the study by Dr. Cheng and colleagues, we've explored how using micropipette aspiration directly inside the Xenopus oocyte nucleus revealed that the nucleolus isn't uniformly liquid. Instead, it has these distinct solid-like DFCFC and liquid-like GC regions. And a key conclusion is that this physical difference is profoundly dependent on RNA, which seems to form a structural network in the core.
Exactly. And the interpretation, the significance, is that this spatial organization of material properties isn't just incidental. It likely plays a fundamental, active role in ensuring the precise, orderly progression of ribosome assembly. It's a powerful illustration of the cell using soft matter physics to organize its chemistry.
This research really advances how we think about cellular compartmentalization, especially beyond the usual membrane-bound organelles. It definitely leaves us with a provocative thought to consider. If the cell employs physical properties like stiffness and fluidity, controlled by molecules like RNA, to orchestrate something as vital and intricate as making ribosomes, what other complex cellular processes may be controlling which genes are active or how signals are relayed might be similarly governed by the physical material state of the condensates involved.
It really opens up a whole new dimension of cellular control and organization that we're just beginning to appreciate and understand. There's likely much more to discover about how cells use physics.
This episode is based on an open access article under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License, CC BY 4.0. You'll find the DOI and a link to the license in the episode description.